A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
The Cannonball is a member of the Agora Podcast Network, and if you enjoy our show, then be sure to check out some of the others on the network, like Royfield Brown's 10 American Presidents, a show about landmark presidencies. Each show features an expert narrator giving their take on the life of one of the presidents, as well as a dramatic score and audio clips to create a whole listening experience. For more information on 10 American Presidents, go to 10usp.com. And for more information on the shows on the network, go to agorapodcastnetwork.com. And if you want more of The Cannonball, check out our blog at thecannonballpodcast.wordpress.com. You'll see our occasional scribblings on canonical things, as well as the order in which we're tackling the canon. You can also find us on Twitter at CannonballPod or on Facebook if you look for our group. Rate and review us on iTunes. Thanks and enjoy the show. We have a new sponsor. It's Online Great Books, a reading program that explores classic texts and that puts you in the habit of reading them. If you're interested in developing a habit of reading classic books by authors like Homer, Nietzsche, Cicero, Spinoza, and more, go to OnlineGreatBooks.com. OnlineGreatBooks.com is designed to help you develop a regular habit of reading the great books, weekly reading goals, reading reminders, accountability tools, and a dedicated community of fellow readers help keep you on track and on schedule with your reading. The OnlineGreatBooks.com check-in and reading goals system is designed to help you progress through the great books with just 3 one-hour reading sessions each week. Every month, OnlineGreatBooks.com ships a carefully selected edition of one of the great books directly to your home. We begin with Homer and progress through works by Plato, Aristotle, Descartes, Shakespeare, through the moderns. Each month, you'll meet in a 2-hour video conference to discuss your text with a small community of readers in a Socratic seminar led by a trained Socratic host. Go to onlinebooks.com to join the VIP list and receive an executive book summary, a digest of the reading list, and more. If you're interested in developing a lifelong habit of reading and studying the great books, go to onlinegreatbooks.com and enter the promo code CAN, that's C-A-N, to get 25% off your first 3 months. Hi, this is Claude from The Cannonball. Today we have something a little different. Etymologically, errancy, particularly in the term knight-errancy, is derived from the same root as error. Now, error in contemporary terms means the wrong way, but applied to errancy, it comes closer in meaning to a diversion or digression from the expected route. Your knight errant was one who typically had no clearly expected route, so he went wherever the road or his horse took him. Part of the adventure was what happened whenever you went off course or had no course and just happened upon an unintended endeavor. And accidentals are the nature of life. And of Don Quixote, a novel both planned and improvised. So consider this episode something of an attempt at errancy, and if I'm in error, rest assured, after a few mishaps in the woods, some run-ins with the Holy Order, and a loss of a couple of teeth, I'm sure I'll be back where we started either on foot, by horse, or teleported while caged by an enchanter. Now, Daniel and I are diligently working our way through Don Quixote. If you haven't noticed, the book is a little big, and we're only just getting started with background information. This is going to be a big one. Probably a couple of big ones. But we didn't want to go on hiatus just to make sure we get through the book. I invited on a writer friend of mine, Chris Ludovici, to give some insights from his reading of Don Quixote and on literature in general. I've actually been wanting to get Chris on for a while. In the first place, he has a book out, The Miners, from the Unsolicited Press. It's a great read, and I'm always happy to tell more people to check it out. There's a link to buy it in the show notes, and I'll be writing about it on the blog as well. Aside from that, Chris has a really fascinating relationship with literature and the claims of high art. I don't want to give too much away, mostly because our conversation is really less about Cervantes and more about growing up in and around an intellectual milieu that makes you extremely skeptical of that milieu. Chris is the furthest thing from an anti-intellectual. In fact, I'd say he's ready, willing, and able to apply his intellect to all number of manner and endeavors. But he's suspicious of some of the expectations for the effects of engaging in culture with a capital C. The gist of our conversation is that being cultured isn't necessarily the same thing as being functional. And Chris goes into that in detail. So enjoy this side path. We'll be back to the regular road soon. Hello, and welcome to The Cannonball, a podcast attempt to read all of the books in Harold Bloom's list of the Western canon. Usually I'm joined by my co-host, Daniel Doherty, but today we've got a little something special. My friend and the writer, Chris Ludovicki, is joining us to talk about Don Quixote and also the writing process and his own recent novel, The Miners. Chris, how you doing?
Oh, I'm doing really good, thanks. And just real quick, it's actually Ludovici.
Ludovici, no,
yeah, because okay. It's ICI, people get confused. But yeah, it's Ludovici.
Yeah, you're a great good friend of mine. And
name pronunciation aside.
Sure. Okay, yeah. Gotcha. Okay, so I wanted to talk to you because you read Don Quixote without my asking you to.
Yeah, pretty much.
Okay, it's kind of interesting because you have a really sort of fascinating, I guess, relationship with high art and with canonical literature or with canonical culture or high art culture, whatever you want to call it. And you're a novelist yourself, and you wrote me, I guess, about a year ago, a year and a half ago, looking for good translations of Don Quixote, and I recommended the Grossman one. Mm-hmm. And this kind of surprised me because I didn't know if this would be up your alley. And that's sort of my first question for you is, why were you reading Don Quixote? What was it that you were sort of expecting or what was it that you wanted to get out of it?
You know, I don't think I had a real expectation or idea other than I was going to read this book. Like, I just wanted to read it, you know, like when I was a kid. Okay, so you know Bone, the comic, the Jeff Smith comic? So you know how Phone Bone is obsessed with Moby Dick, right? Like that's a thing of his character. And he's always going on and on about it. And one of the things about Moby Dick is that it's a hard read, right? That was always what people said about it, is it's a hard read. So I decided, I don't know, 8 or 9 years ago that I was going to read it, and I found it to be a really easy read. Mm-hmm. Like, it's a really readable book. It's a lot of fun. There's a lot of great information. It's not like, I don't really dig on James Joyce that much because I spend half the sentence trying to figure out what the sentence is saying. You know what I mean? Like, I'm not at, we got into that sort of Facebook discussion a long time ago. Poetry and we don't always mix. Mm-hmm. And it's like I found Melville to be, I mean, he's lyrical, but he's also just a very good technical writer. Like, it's very easy to understand what everybody's doing, why they're doing it. And, you know, the pleasure in reading it is not necessarily the words, although the words are lovely, but it's also about what the people are thinking and doing. Anyway, so I read it and I just really enjoyed it. And so, like, every once in a while, you're just like, I'm going to read, you know, one of the books, the capital T, the capital B books. And you would mention Don Quixote, and I've never read Don Quixote. And it's like, well, I'll read Don Quixote. I've read Moby Dick. I've read The Brothers Karamazov. I've read, I don't know, like you go down. I've read, you know, Sense and Sensibility. I've read, like, those books that you're supposed to read. I try to read them. And so this was the time for that one.
Well, this is the thing that, you know, I really wanted to talk to you about, because I always really respect your viewpoints on a lot of things. I don't always agree with you, but I respect where you're coming from. You're not thoughtless. Okay, that sounds like damning with faint praise, but even the things that I'm like, okay, I can't get on board with this with you, you still come at them from a place of having really considered, thought through it, worked through it, and you always fall back on, hey, look, I realize this isn't for everyone, but this is how I'm getting at this, this is how I think about this, this is what I really find aesthetically affecting about this, and I will stand by this. Okay, to give the audience or our listeners a little bit of viewpoint, you have the most impassioned take on two things that I really cannot get into, but I really respect your take. The Star Wars prequels and the Matrix sequels.
It's true. I have feelings about both of them.
But it's not just feelings, it's thoughts.
Right, yes.
You're impassioned about those things, but it's not coming from a kind of reflective sort of gag reflex fanboy sort of way.
Right.
It's you've worked on these things, and the conceptual viewpoint that you've developed is something that you argue, not, okay, I say argue in terms of presenting evidence and analyzing the evidence, not argue as
right.
in
yeah, like you're wrong
back and
forth.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I understand what you're saying, and for me, I like thinking about things, which I don't think everybody does. You know, like one of the things that I find really interesting about Facebook as like a social tool is that, like, if you get into a conversation with somebody on a thread, it can go like 20 or 30 or sometimes 40 back and forth. And some people are really like put off by that. They just automatically say, no, this is a fight, like, as opposed to a sort of an argument, right? Like this is two people who are angry at each other, or one person's being a jerk. And it's like, well, no, what's interesting about an idea is often, or what makes an idea interesting is not the first couple levels. It's like getting down to the bone of a thing. Right. And I think, you know, back to the sort of Star Wars and Matrix movies, and I think they're both flawed, Matrix less so, because I really do like them, but like, is that these were movies that had a point of view. They were trying to do something, and they're both intermittently successful at doing it, but like, it's really interesting to me to see them both trying to do that. You know, it's interesting to see somebody try to, we're talking about Don Quixote, right? Which is a great work of literature. It's a book, and it does all of the things that books can do really well. It goes deep inside certain things, and it has stories within stories within stories, and it's got a lot of wordplay, and it's got a lot of puns and a lot of references, and those are the types of things that books do really, really well. And, like, one of the things movies do really well is show you things, right? It's like I always said, the reason that Jurassic Park is a great movie and Jurassic Park is a dumb book, among other things, is any idiot can type dinosaur. You know? And it's like, you can, but if you make a dinosaur the thing, it's like, that's what a movie is for. And I love those movies that are trying to talk about things but are also trying to show me things, you know, like spaceships and crazy, you know, breaks in reality, because that's what movies are for.
That's the other thing that I really sort of respect about you, is that you're coming at this from a lot of different places.
I try to.
That it's kind of a magpie approach, which I think is the best possible approach to apply that thoughtfulness, or to apply that sort of intellectual critique or analysis to as wide a variety of material as possible. And that's what I'm sort of saying, is that hits at this project.
Right.
That it's not about a set of standard works that you're trying to, you know, match the height of or something like that, but it's rather what is the aesthetic effect?
Right.
And if it doesn't have an effect, well, then scrap it. And if it does have an effect, no matter where it's coming from, then articulate that. And that's what I like about your perspective.
Oh, thank you. And I will say that one of the things I really like about reading older books, you know, books from the past that I find really interesting is that we do, we like the sort of listicle world that we live in now is really obsessed with ranking things and trying to figure out, well, what are the best versions of whatever? And a lot of times those are things that you can't decide in the moment. Yeah. You know, they're things that, that, no, they just have to last. You know, something, what part of what makes something great is that people still care about it in the future. And that's just not something that you can project. But, right. But the sort of weird, interesting tension of something like Don Quixote or, again, any, you know, Dickens or Dostoevsky or anything is that the books aren't written a lot of times for history. They're written for the present. Right. So they're filled with, like, this copy of Don Quixote that you recommended, the Edith Grossman one. It's got some small footnotes. It's not like footnote heavy. And a lot of what the footnotes are is just to tell you, oh yeah, this was a book that was popular at this time. Or yeah. This was a person who lived in that area. And so like, this is a book that almost all books exist in context. You know, like
yeah.
It's in conversation with what's happening in the world at that time. But sort of what makes it, one of the things that makes that interesting is we're not reading it at that time. So what does it mean now? Which is, again, it's sort of the same thing you're saying, but it's trying to relate it specifically to this book or any book. You know, does that make sense?
Yeah, no, that makes total sense. It's okay. There's I'm going to bring up poetry, and I know you hate that, but there's a contemporary poet, Frank Bidart.
Okay.
And he has this prose poem called Borges and I. About the Borges fiction, Borges and I. Mm-hmm. And it starts with this line that he repeats, you know, we fill pre-existing forms, and when we fill them, we change them and are changed.
Right.
And his whole idea is that, like, history isn't static.
Right.
It's not absolutely chaotic because it's got these parameters to it. Mm-hmm. And we go back to old forms, we go back to old models, but when we inhabit them in a new context, we do something different with it. And I think that's what you're getting at, is that the reading of the text in the moment, you know, it's something different than it was back then.
Yeah.
But it's also within certain kinds of parameters for how we still consider the thing.
Yeah. Like a thing for me that was really a sort of a seminal moment in my reading life.
Yeah.
Was reading Pride and Prejudice a little more than 10 years ago and talking to my mom about it. Now my mom is like she was an English major at Swarthmore College. She loves Austen and 18th, 19th century English literature. So, you know, I was just constantly going to her for context just about the world. And at a certain point, I was talking to her and I remember saying to her, oh, I get it. Like, this is a suspense novel. This is an action novel, right? Because these people's lives are on the line. And like when in You've Got Mail, when Meg Ryan breaks up with Greg Kinnear without knowing that she's going to end up with Tom Hanks, spoiler alert, that's not going to have a real material, like, okay, she's going to be a little sad, but she's not going to lose her home. You know, she couldn't potentially be destitute. Whereas the decisions that the characters make in Austen have like a real profound immediate effect on their lives.
Oh yeah, you know? I mean it is life and death.
Like
I think you're getting at what a lot of people misread in Austen.
Yeah.
We think of romance as
soothing.
Strictly in terms of emotion and perhaps sexuality.
Right.
And there's a whole economics.
Exactly. And it's like,
that Austen was clear-eyed about.
Yeah, these people could this would have a real, I mean, it's not exactly Die Hard, but it's not that far off. Like these people's futures when Lizzie Bennett doesn't go off with Reverend whatever his name is, I don't remember, like she's not just making a decision for her happiness. She's affecting everybody else in her family, and really, she's risking them all, and like that's a moment of risk. And anyway, I think, you know, like when we're what I think is really fascinating again is that stuff that a reader in Austen's time would take for granted, you know. So that's not really, the book is about the economics of it, as you say, but when we read it now, we get all these different things out of it, but also it's a way to understand the way. It's a way to look at all the stuff that those people took for granted about the world that they lived in.
Yeah.
You know, the subtext, all the stuff that they're not talking about is the stuff that makes it valuable, because it's like, oh, this is why this matters so much.
You know, exactly.
This
exactly.
is why this has weight in a way that, like, Bridget Jones's Diary doesn't. And I've never read Bridget Jones's Diary. It was, it was a cute movie, but you know what I'm saying? It's that same thing. It's like, well, if she doesn't get together with Mr. Darcy or whatever Hugh Grant's character's name is, again, she's still going to be a reporter the next day.
Right.
You know,
right.
she's still.
And the stakes are larger in Austin.
That's what I'm saying. Yeah. That, it's yeah. like, it's like, no, you, like you may have made your, you may have actually put your sister's lives at risk because there's, yeah. you know, it's not like they were going to go get, you know, on public assistance and like, and just get food stamps until they could figure out how to get a job. It's like, no, it's a much harder thing. And
yeah,
like, and that gives it. That gives it depth and it gives it weight, and so I think understanding those things can really materially affect something. I don't know if it does specifically for Don Quixote, which is what I'd like to talk to you about.
Well, okay,
yeah,
we'll get there, but I want to ask you a side question.
Uh-huh.
Okay, so you brought up your mom and Swarthmore and her mm-hmm. as an English major. Okay, so what exactly is your relationship to this sort of high culture? And I'm asking you this after having known a little bit about you and known some of your writings, mm-hmm. but you've written, I think, very touchingly and convincingly mm-hmm. about the gains and the losses of really valuing high culture. I mean, mm-hmm. could you talk about that a little bit?
I can try. I mean, I think for me, I was thinking about this the other day. I actually, I just got a job at Swarthmore, not like teaching or anything. I'm working on the campus as a way to just sort of make money so I can keep working on writing when I'm not at my job. And one of the things I think is really interesting, and I was saying this to my coworker, is that you know, there are all these kids that were doing tours of the campus this week, students who were going to be there next year. And I was saying, you know, kids work so hard to get to Swarthmore. They work yeah. so hard. And this for them is the thing that they are, that their lives are staked on, you know, where they come to become the people that they're going to be. But it's filled with kids who live in Swarthmore who can't wait to get the fuck out of Swarthmore. Right?
Which well, is, that's what your novel is about.
Exactly. Exactly. And it's like there is, I grew up surrounded by people who felt about where they lived exactly the same way everybody else felt about where they lived, except my people lived in the destination for everybody else.
Right. Like,
does that make sense? So for me, what that sort of is a metaphor for in my mind is high art or education or a lot of these things are the tools that we use to get where we need to go.
Mm-hmm.
And there are other tools. That doesn't mean that high art isn't a valuable tool or that education isn't a valuable tool. It just means that it's only one of the tools.
Right.
And
right.
I think that for me, it took me a long time to accept that mm-hmm. because the same way, you know, the same way somebody might grow up in like, what they consider to be, you know, a podunk nowhere town in the middle of nowhere, surrounded by idiots who didn't know anything about anything.
You're kind of hitting close to home.
Well, I grew up in, again, an intellectual mecca filled right. with brilliant people who were idiots and didn't know anything about anything. Right? Because not.
Well, yeah. I mean, I think that's been, you know, okay. This is where I'm coming from mm-hmm. is that, throughout the 20th century,
yeah.
there's been this obsession with education and yeah. in the, let's say 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s, mm-hmm. education, particularly in the liberal arts and in, I guess what you could call high culture.
Yeah.
As a means of transcending where you came from.
Right.
And it's weird. I was thinking about this. All right, I'm going to go back to poetry, and I know mm-hmm. you hate poetry.
I don't hate it that much. I just don't understand it. Consider me with poetry like a person who can't carry a tune. Do you know what I mean? Like, I just can't sing.
Yeah, we're going to sit down and talk at one point.
Okay, well,
and
that's a different podcast. It's
going to be all right.
All right.
But no, there's this narrative in 20th century American poetry. Mm-hmm. And I could name you, you know, half a dozen writers right off the bat that is their narrative. They were poor kids from the middle of nowhere, mm-hmm. or wherever they considered the middle of nowhere. They got some kind of scholarship to go and read English. Mm-hmm. And then pursued an MFA and became quote-unquote successful
right.
by transcending their background through the act of creating poetry, which is the highest of high arts.
Right.
I'm not saying it's the highest of high arts.
No, I understand.
I'm saying there's a cultural perspective.
Well, and I think there's something to that. Poetry is really hard.
Like, no, it's not.
Some of it is.
No, it's not.
Okay, well then, again, that's for our next conversation.
Hey, yeah. All right, yeah, that's for the next conversation, but that's what I'm going to throw down right now.
Okay.
Is that we've been conned into believing that poetry and poetics is much more difficult than it is.
Okay.
And that's because your high school teachers are awful.
Well, I'll buy that. I think we can agree on that.
All right.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
All right. But anyway, you have written a novel, and that's what I'm kind of curious about, is what do you think that the novel does, right? Like, it doesn't quite do what movies do. It doesn't quite do what comic books do. It does this particular thing.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so what is it? What exactly is it from your standpoint that you think the novel does?
Okay, well, the thing that I like about the novel, the thing I think that makes the novel most interesting and sort of not elevates it, but distinguishes it from every other type of art, is that the novel gives you an opportunity to watch somebody else's mind work. Right? You think about a song, right? And a song is beautiful. It can move you. It can touch you. It can make you feel things that you've never felt before, right? And watching somebody, as a performer, watching somebody perform something, whether it be in acting or watching a dancer, again, like, these are things that can have these intense emotional reactions, and even moments of empathy, but it's empathy through seeing something. But when you're reading a book, like a really good book, the books I sort of like the most, a lot of them are about taking you through the steps that somebody's mind takes to reach a conclusion. And I think that's a really important thing, because it's a way for a person to look at another person who they may have nothing in common with and say, well, that's a person like me. You know, like, they might have different numbers, but they're using the same math that I am. They're using the same algebraic equations. They're just putting in different integers for variables. And I think that that's, like, an incredibly important thing, because that's a tool for empathy. It is a way for people to not hate each other. And I mean, again, it's, they're always for people to not hate each other, but, like, The novel for me is a way to show how the person who you can't see into their head. You can never really see into another person's head, but it's a way to sort of say, oh, the inside of their head is like the inside of my head.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, one of the things that you and I have talked about before briefly is I like Michael Bay, and right? I do. And one of the reasons I like Michael Bay is I like watching robots punch each other. You know, like, I like the sort of I like the cutting. I like the rhythm. I like the sort of fact that I'm looking at something that I never in a million years could imagine. I never in a million years would take the time to create or render, right? Like, I couldn't picture it and I couldn't do it. And it's so fun for me to watch it because I've never seen it. But that is, again, that's like a sensory experience. That's exciting for me. It excites me. It hits the lizard 11-year-old part of my brain. But when I'm reading Austin,
yeah,
when I'm reading Roth, when right. I'm reading, you know, again, Richard Ford is a person who was one of the – have you ever read any Ford?
Yeah.
He was a guy that for me was foundational for that kind of thing. And it's a funny thing because I read Independence Day in 1996 after it won the Pulitzer Prize. But the reason that I read it is because there was a story. The book is called Independence Day. And in 1996, the biggest movie of the year was Independence Day. And this is 100% true. People were buying the Richard Ford book because they thought it was a novelization of the Roland Emmerich movie. And they were furious that that's not what it was. So you had people who were returning books that was a Pulitzer Prize winning work of art because it wasn't a novelization of aliens coming out and attacking and Will Smith punching them, which I thought was just fabulous. So I was like, I got to read this book. I think that's great. I think that's the funniest thing I've ever heard. I got to read this book. But yeah, it was this. So it's sort of like the combination, right, of you know, you got to go through Michael Bay or Roland Emmerich sometimes to get to the Richard Ford.
Well, that gets at something that I was going to ask you is, okay, so your book, in some ways, it's, well, okay, when you say that, I kind of see where you're coming from. The Miners, in a lot of ways, is about family relationships, but also relationships between people. And you've got these kind of, like, the protagonist is this kind of laconic dude. Sometimes you kind of hate him.
I hope so. I mean,
yeah. I think you did that on purpose. But in a lot of ways, you do also get behind him because, well, there's some shifts. There are some things that he begins to see. There are some things he can't see.
Yeah.
And there's some blind spots. So it's about these interpersonal interactions, mm-hmm, and these things that are, you know, often very class-based.
Yeah.
Like,
oh, yeah.
What are the things that, even though we live in the same town, block us from kind of interacting with each other?
Well, and how do we take each other for granted? You know, yeah, what I mean? Like, I grew up in Swarthmore, which is a wonderful town full of wonderful people, who constantly had students or people from, you know, outside of the town, you know, whether it be just out of town or whatever, coming into their homes. You know, they were, yeah, constantly doing construction, or they were tutors, or they were au pairs, or they were, you know, they were working outside, building things, whatever. And it's sort of so fascinating because they didn't, like, it's not like what you see in the movies where it's like, you know, they would go up to somebody and be like, now I want you to, you know, like, speaking to them like they're idiots. They would actually be very, like, these rich people would be very comfortable and confident around these other people, and you don't know who they are. And I don't mean, yeah, I don't mean that in a sort of alarmist reactionary way. I just mean you don't know who these people are. And
like, as human beings.
Yeah. Like, we just don't know.
Like, what is this person's life?
Yeah,
what,
right,
are their beliefs?
Yeah.
How do they think about things? What are their, you know, who are they as human beings?
Yeah, what are their values?
I think that's what you're getting at, is that that's what I took away from your book.
Oh,
is
good.
That there's the sort of internalization.
Mm-hmm.
There's the inner life that each of us has. And there are these things that sort of block us off from acknowledging that or even being able to interpret that.
Yeah.
Like, okay, the sort of crux of the novel is that there's this guy who he's doing basically contracting work mm-hmm. on the house of this rich family that's sort of, you know, packing up and getting ready to move.
Yeah.
And he gets sort of closer and closer to the family.
Yeah.
And becomes kind of like a de facto member of the family.
Like, yeah. Like
kind of a mentor.
Say that basically the story of the book is that there's this family and the father says one day at dinner, he says, "Good news, I got a promotion at my job. Bad news, we're moving. I have to leave at the end of the week. I'm going to Chicago. And you kids, there's a daughter and a son, a girl and a boy. You're going to stay behind, finish out the school year. Your mom's going to get the house ready for sale. And then you're going to come join me in Chicago." So the story takes place mostly in that interim. And it's about the vacuum that this guy leaves when he leaves the situation, and the contractor sort of gets sucked into that. He becomes a sort of a surrogate father, surrogate husband, sort of older brother figure. And he is a person who is not up to the task,
right.
But he's not unwilling. Like, he is a person who wants to try to do this. He just can't.
Right. And that's the thing, is that we each have our own inner life.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
We each have our own circumstances that we're coming at this from. And we make all kinds of interpretations based on our own situation, mm-hmm. based on our own background, based on our own circumstances.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. How do we negotiate those?
Exactly. And sort of like, you know, we were talking earlier about sort of high culture versus low culture. And there was a moment in a documentary that I saw once about the making of Jaws that stuck with me forever, much like the Independence Day thing, where Spielberg was talking about, he realized that what made Jaws scary, the movie, was he had to put the camera in the water. He said, if I put the camera even an inch above the water, the audience wasn't scared. The audience was watching a shark chase somebody else. But if you put the camera in the water, then the audience is in the water with the shark. Mm-hmm. And what I sort of like to do with my books and my stories is to try to put the audience in the water. So, like, what is Sam's problem? Even if it's, like, in the first part of the story, I cut my hair without telling my mom, and now she's mad at me. When you're 16 and you have no, you know, that's a shark, man. That's a thing that's terrifying to you, right? Because your world is your house. Your world is your parents. Your world is your friends. Mm-hmm. And that is a thing that is terrifying, that I have made this leap and I don't know what's going to happen to me.
Right.
And it's like really, it's really easy if you're outside of the water to say, well, that's not scary. Who cares? It's just hair. It'll grow back. But when we're 16, that's not how it is, because you know, our shark is a different shark. My shark, as a 39-year-old man, is probably the same shark, some of the same sharks as your sharks. You know, taking care of our kids, putting food on the table. You know, making, you know, being enough of adults that our wives don't leave us. You know, like, these are things that matter way more than hair. But like, a 16-year-old girl has no knowledge of that. This is just the scariest thing that's happened to her, which is different than the scariest thing for a 28-year-old man, which in the first story, the first part of the story is, I might be a dad. You know?
Like, yeah.
This girl that I'm dating might be pregnant, and how am I going to handle that? And like, but the point is that they're both scared. You know, the point is not that Nick's fear is more real or more legitimate than Sam's fear. The point is they're both frightened.
Right.
And they both are able to navigate it or not navigate it. But in the first part of the story, they navigate it. You know, they don't know. Again, spoiler, nobody dies in the first 50 pages of my book. but like, you know, but there's something that's scary that's put in front of them that they need to overcome. And the scariness is relative to their lives, to what's scary to them, which again brings us back to empathy. You know, Nick's fear is different from Sam's fear, but they're both fear. You know, like their glands work the same way. They both sweat, you know, cold sweat. They both are frightened. And that's hopefully, like, the reader goes, well, I too am frightened.
All right.
You know what it's like to be frightened, I guess.
Well, okay. So that brings us back to sort of what we were talking about before.
Mm-hmm.
The the work in its own context, the work in the historical context, and the work today.
Right.
Did you – okay, just personally, did you get any of that not necessarily fear but mm-hmm. empathy from Don Quixote?
Oh, big time. Big time. I mean, I think what's really interesting about Don Quixote for me – mm-hmm. a couple of things, but the thing that I thought was really interesting is that it is ultimately a story about people's relationships with stories, right? Yeah. Like, you have in Don Quixote a man who is deluded or crazy or willfully something, but he is inspired by the nonsense that he reads to go out and have adventures. And that's really what the first half of the story is about. But the second half of the story, which in some ways I liked more, is about people's reaction to reading his story.
Yeah.
You know, he has now become the thing that he wants to be, although not the same. He's a comic version of it, right? But, like, he's talking about the great deeds of... I'm sorry, I don't remember their names, but, you know...
Nobody does. Okay, don't worry about it.
So, you know, but the great deeds of Sir Whoever and Sue, and whatever, and Don that guy, but now he's somebody. And so the story is sort of... The interesting thing about the story to me is how all of these different people react
yeah.
to these stories. Don Quixote reads these ridiculous stories and thinks, I'm going to go out and be a great person. I want to be great, you know, and it's foolish and it's ridiculous, but it's sweet. You know, yeah. he wants to make the world a better place. And then in the second half of the book, he runs into a bunch of assholes. We're like, who read the story and go, look at this idiot. Let's have some fun with him. You know, like it's sort of the difference between what we call punching up and punching down, right? Yeah. That like it's a story about how, again, like sometimes stories can bring out the best or the worst in us, and you mm-hmm. see both of them in that. You know,
yeah, that's what was striking to me is that you responded more to the second part than the first part. And okay, I'm going to get into this with Daniel more, mm-hmm. but that's kind of the critical cliche, but it's got some weight to it. I mean, mm-hmm. there really is something to it. The first book is the Renaissance book. And then the second book is the Baroque book.
Okay.
And what that means sort of is the first book in some ways is the more humanist and mm-hmm. the more positive.
Right.
And the more sort of recycling stories and having fun with it.
Yeah.
And the second book is much darker.
Yeah.
And much more introspective.
Yeah.
And much more, I guess, self-enfolded in this weird kind of way.
Yeah, yeah.
Maybe this is asking too much, but why did you respond more to the second book? Is it that kind of darkening or thoughtfulness about the situation of the first book that – or that reflection that sort of struck you?
I think actually it's interesting because I think it's because I understood it better. Like okay. you and I were talking earlier about context and about yeah. when you're reading a story, you know, that stories aren't written for history. They're written for the present. And then when we look back on them, you know, they're very interesting because we have it's helpful to understand the world that the story was written in. And one of the things about the first book, and I didn't even know it was two books when I started it. I just thought mm-hmm. it was, you know, Don Quixote. I didn't know there were two of them. So one of the things that I was really interested in when I started it was what is this about, right? What is this thing that I'm reading? And so I was right. reading this, like, it was comic, it was funny. Like, I really enjoyed, you know, Sancho not just getting beaten up, but being really sore, like literally hurting. And that a lot of the story isn't just about the story, you know, the first part of the story isn't just about the sort of the comic fallacy of trying to do these things, but about the sort of the cost of it. It's like your teeth get knocked out.
Like, that's okay. Terry Gilliam has been trying to make this movie again and again and again.
Ironically.
And I feel like it needs to be a joint project between Terry Gilliam and Werner Herzog. Yeah. That Gilliam needs to be the one to direct all of the most mundane parts of the book. But all of the delusions need to be directed by Herzog.
I would do you one better. I think the first part should be directed by, like, Lord and Miller. You know, like, guys who are, like, you know, the guys who made the Lego movie, right? Like, guys who are really up with people and are, like, writing, you know, about these sort of good-hearted dopes that are going into the world and having adventures.
But it's sort of like, okay, all of the delusion, the parts where Don Quixote is expounding on, you know, this, that, and the other, and living in a real world that is extraordinarily banal and mundane. That needs to be Gilliam. Where he's getting the stuffing knocked out of him and his teeth are flying everywhere and there's blood all over the place, that needs to be Herzog,
I guess. But let me say this. I don't think Gilliam likes people. Like, I don't want to get into a whole Terry Gilliam thing, but I mean, like, you look at his movies and I don't think he really likes people very much. And getting back to what you were saying about the romantic book, I think that Cervantes, especially in that first book, he really likes a lot of the people, you know, involved. Like, he thinks they're dopey. He thinks they're silly. But I think a lot of them he thinks are decent, you know, and good.
He really does.
I don't think Gilliam feels that way about people in general.
I would kind of agree with you on that. But the second book, he's not necessarily misanthropic, but there is this kind of knowingness that I think is
he's disappointed. That's sort of what I meant when I said I understood it better. Mm-hmm. You know, because the first one is not just a book about, it's not just those things that we talked about, and those things are delightful. It's also like, and I wrote you this, right? Why does Spain only have like 9 people in it? You know, because like he runs into like, you know, this guy who tells this story about how he, you know, had 3 brothers and like, you know, he met this woman when he was in, you know, when he was somewhere in the Middle East and he escaped and he has this woman, he's trying to find his brothers. And then one of the brothers just shows up. You know, and then there another brother shows up. And I was saying to you, I was saying, like, I don't quite understand. Am I supposed to think that this is, am I laughing that this is happening? Is this just some early, like, you know, is this just before literature got around to trying to be realistic about its presentation of the world in terms of, like, probability? Like, what is happening here? And
well, okay, that's in the first part, right?
Yeah. And what I was saying is that I just found that you'd asked me which part, you know, I like the second part more because I was able to understand the disappointment in people much more easily than I was able to understand the sort of narrative games of the first one, where I was I was like, why is this happening? Like,
so the narrative games are sort of part of that Renaissance tradition. Mm-hmm. There's kind of this critical, up until the 20th century, I believe, mm-hmm. there was this critical tradition of reading Cervantes as a kind of naive writer. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And that fit into the view, okay, I'm not Spanish. Mm-hmm. Did you know that?
I don't know what Guzer is. I don't know if that's Spanish or Russian. I don't know.
Ask my father. Mm-hmm. He's the one who made up the term.
Right.
I'm not self-invented. I suppose my father was. But according to as much as I've read, mm-hmm. the critical consensus is sort of like there was this romanticized view of Spain that mm-hmm. needed Cervantes to be naive.
Okay.
That needed him to be sort of unread. Mm-hmm. And there were lots of writers in Golden Age Spain that were coming from a lot of different sort of backgrounds and traditions, mm-hmm. a lot of them very intellectual and intellectualized.
Oh, I see what you're saying. Yeah.
Yeah. And the reality is that Cervantes spent a lot of his formative years in Italy.
Okay.
He knew Italian, or sort of functional Italian. He knew how to read, and he read the Italian texts. Mm. So he read something like Boccaccio, which is a bunch of short stories, but all linked together according to an overarching narrative. And you get variations and permutations within Boccaccio, kind of like a fugue.
Okay.
You know? It's sort of like, okay, here's a story, here's a counter story.
Right.
That works in similar – along similar lines, and here's a counter story.
Right, yeah.
That works according to that. So what he does in the first book of Don Quixote is very much in that Italian Renaissance vein.
Oh, that's fascinating.
That here's story, counter story – here's my shift on reality.
Yeah.
Here's my meta-narratorial shift on the unreality of narration.
Right.
And here's this, here's that. Mm-hmm. And I think the difference is in Cervantes, it's all kind of provisional.
Mm-hmm.
Like he's – the critical consensus is that he's not exactly making it up as he goes along.
Mm-hmm.
But it's partially overarching narrative, partially, hey, let's see just what happens in this chapter.
Yeah, because I think – I mean, it's interesting that you said that to me, that the sort of naivete, or that he wasn't like that intellectual a writer to me, because knowing nothing about, you know, Spain at the time – so much of the book, the first part especially, is so clearly a critique of storytelling and the value of storytelling and the drawbacks of storytelling. It almost reminds me in that respect of, and I'm going back to movies again, but of somebody like Tarantino, that this is a person who is extremely well-versed. You know what I mean? Like, you don't have to know everything Tarantino is referencing to see that he's referencing things and right. that he has a sort of a – that he's talking to all these other things that matter to him. And I sort of feel the same way about Cervantes. It's like there's just – there's like literal pages of the book where they're just going through people's libraries talking about books and sort of going, you know, oh, this is a good one. This is shit. You know, this is interesting. I like that. That you don't need. And like, and then you as the reader are going, well, just okay. Just because the characters are saying that, like, what does Cervantes think of it? Because the person who has said that in the case of, say, Don Quixote is a madman, you know, or some of the people who, some of the other people are people who maybe are, you know, you're like, well, that guy seems like to have his good head on his shoulders, but he's pretty mean to Don Quixote, and I don't like that he's mean to Don Quixote. So what does his opinion mean, you know, of this work?
That's the thing, is that the second book is occasioned by the fact that somebody wrote a bad sequel.
Yeah. No, I thought that was amazing. That was so weird to me. And again, like, I think I told you I know I keep coming back to high and low art, but that is what I think is really interesting. Is it reminded me of like the Arrested Development, where do you remember the one in the second season, I think, where they're doing where Carl Weathers is directing an episode of some true crime TV show
The
blues, and Ron Howard is the narrator, keeps taking time to dump on the narration of the other version. And I think that's really interesting, again, because we think, I know for a long time, I think it's just sort of like this, this default position to think of high art and low art as being separate things, and of sort of great works of art as being these things that are in the past, and that they involve things that we don't do or that we wouldn't understand. You know what I mean? But this idea is, it's like, no, the games that Cervantes are playing are the same games that Quentin Tarantino is playing, or that, you know, that Arrested Development's playing, or that Kanye West is playing, you know, these are the same games. They're just part of what makes something high versus low is A, how long it's lasted, and B, who's doing it.
Right.
Is it's like if it's, cause this is the canon, right? Like, that's what we're talking about. If it's, if it's stuffy white guys in the past doing it, it's high art. But if it's sort of, you know, if it's music for, if it's pop music, you know, which traditionally is music for the hoi polloi, you know, that's low art, which I don't think is necessarily I don't think that's necessarily a bad distinction so much as I think that the value, they're still playing with the same toys and they're still using the same ideas. Mm-hmm. And that these are things that are still alive. And they're ways of getting back to empathy. They're ways of sort of looking back and saying, we have always been asking these questions that we're asking. It is all about our relationships with the things that teach us, mm-hmm. right? That it sort of is about, when you think about like what Kanye does, right? Is he's playing, you know, he mixes in all that old soul music, or at least what he used to do back when he was, you know, what we think of as sort of traditional Kanye stuff, is he's playing the music that he grew up with, but putting a contemporary spin on it. He's rapping over it. He's speeding it up. He's slowing it down. He's fucking with the voices. He's using production, but it's that same sort of idea as he's saying, you know, this is the stuff that is going to propel me and is going to drive me and took me and made me want to join in on this conversation is kind of similar to what Cervantes is doing. And he's sort of, you know, Cervantes, a lot of what he says is antagonistic, but it also is about the way that stuff inspires people. Because mm-hmm. because Don Quixote, he's a fool. But that doesn't mean that he doesn't in some ways make the world a better place. That doesn't mean that right. he doesn't improve the lives of people around him. You know, right. like... It doesn't matter that he's an idiot. It doesn't matter that he's crazy, you know?
In some ways, the craziness makes it better.
I agree. Yeah, completely. And you and I talked about, like, is he – how crazy is he? What is his madness? Is it's really fascinating. I was thinking while you were talking earlier that one – and I love, obviously, I think. I love movies and I love television. But one of the things that it might have done – that's kind of sad is it's made us had to literalize things.
Yeah.
In a way, you know, because it is, it's I was saying earlier, right, that the difference, you know, it's one thing to write dinosaur when you're Michael Crichton. It's another thing to make a dinosaur when you're Steven Spielberg. Is it's like when we can see something, all of a sudden it's sillier looking, you know?
Yeah.
And it's like we need to make things more possible. Because we're so used to looking at them and visualizing them. And that makes them more real. And the trick of something like Don Quixote isn't just the fantasy stuff. It's not. Like, I could very easily accept that this person was sort of hallucinating that there were giants. I had a lot more trouble with this sort of idea that it's like, as we say, why does he keep running into all these people that know each other?
Right.
But it's like the ultimate thing is because who cares? Like that's what the story dictates, you know, but we're so sort of used to seeing things. It just makes it real. It's like the same way people like complain about the new Star Wars movie that like, it's unrealistic that one spaceship could outrun the other one. As if anything in that movie is really realistic. You know what I mean? As if the notion of airplanes flying through space and dogfighting is cool, but this other thing is not. Anyway, I think that that's an interesting thing to think about, that sort of looking at things, like literally looking at things, sometimes makes it harder to we lose something from that. I don't know. Maybe that's nothing, but it's interesting to me.
I think that gets at what the novel does, and I think that gets at what this novel does. Mm-hmm. I think you're right that perspective and dialogue between all these different viewpoints and empathy is really what we tend to value in this.
Yeah.
You know?
What these stories bring out in the people around them, you know?
Yeah. Whether it's Don Quixote, whether it's something contemporary, whether it's your novel, whether it's whatever, right? This is what these stories do. So, yeah, okay. So Daniel and I are probably going to launch into all kinds of obscure information about Golden Age Spain. But what does this mean now? And I think that's the question to keep asking and the question to keep answering is mm-hmm. to read it and take away from it. And I'm really kind of glad that you dug it, man.
Yeah, well, thank you. I'm glad that I read it. You didn't ask me to read it, but you brought it up. And like, yeah. I don't know if I would have if you hadn't. I remember 20 years ago buying books and being like looking at them on my shelf and feeling like I may die before I read this book. You know what I mean? Right. Like it's just there's so much more to do than there is time to do it. So like I may never have gotten around to it. I don't know.
But it seemed to move at a clip. Well, yeah. Thanks for coming on, man.
Thanks for having me.
I really appreciate your perspective. And everybody, please go out and buy this novel. It's a good one.
Yeah, I like it too.
All right, take care, man.
Cool. See ya.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.